This is The Guardian.
Today, as the Labour Party heads into its annual conference in Brighton, the stakes are high for its leader, Keir Starmer.
Thank you. Conference, thank you. Thank you for that wonderful welcome.
It's been 2 years since the Labour Party physically came together. And back in September 2019, things were very different.
We need to get Brexit sorted and do it in a way that doesn't leave our economy or our democracy broken.
The leader was Jeremy Corbyn. The party were in knots over Brexit, and they didn't know it yet, but they were heading for disaster in that winter's general election.
Our exit poll is suggesting that there will be a Conservative majority of...
The Labour Party saw its worst results since 1935. Dozens of their former heartland seats in the so-called Red Wall were lost to the Conservatives.
That I will not lead the party in any future general election campaign.
Corbyn was gone shortly after, and in his place came Keir Starmer, pitched straight into an extraordinary national crisis, a pandemic.
Under my leadership, we will engage constructively with the government. Not opposition for opposition's sake, not scoring party political points or making impossible demands.
Now, with politics returning to something closer to normal and party conference season upon us again, the task ahead for the leader is clear. Present a vision to the country and win back those lost voters. From The Guardian, I'm Nosheen Iqbal. Today in Focus, a make or break week for Keir Starmer. So Jessica Elgott, you're The Guardian's chief political correspondent, and Keir Starmer was named leader of the Labour Party 2 weeks after the UK went into lockdown last year. That's not an ideal first year for his leadership, is it?
It couldn't be worse as leader of the opposition. I mean, if you're leader of the opposition, your task is incredibly difficult anyway, because as far as most people's interest in politics goes, it's about how it affects their lives. And as leader of the opposition, you don't affect their lives. All you can do is say how their lives could be theoretically better or what the government is theoretically getting wrong. And the problem with a pandemic is that it's so deeply affected everybody's very existence, who you could meet, whether you could kiss your loved ones, whether you lived or died. It infiltrated every single part of our existence. And, you know, even the most hardened anti-Tory wanted the government to succeed in tackling the pandemic. It's very difficult when, even as the leader of the opposition, you have to will the government to succeed in its battle against this terrible disease. And therefore, that means you have to spend a lot of your time kind of meekly supporting what the government is doing. I mean, Starmer has managed to have some general distance between himself and Boris Johnson on minor ways of tackling the pandemic. You know, at the moment, it comes down to, should there be a few extra places where you enforce masks? And it's not a particularly convincing narrative to have to run on. And also, you can't go anywhere. You can't meet anyone. You can't give an impression of yourself as someone who's popular. Jeremy Corbyn did that so successfully, particularly in the run-up to 2017, that what you could see on local TV news stations was, you know, rallies of people coming to support him. And Starmer has never been able to do that. He's been prevented legally from doing anything like that. So yeah, of course it's difficult in those circumstances.
So do we have a sense of his popularity? And has the public formed a view of him at this point?
Whether people have really formed a view on Starmer, I think, is probably questionable. I think an asset to him is they probably haven't formed a negative view of him yet, although that could come. You know, obviously the worst thing that can happen to you and was a big problem that Ed Miliband had, and obviously that Jeremy Corbyn had too, was that by the end of the time they were contesting elections, their enemies, i.e. the Tories, had been allowed to define them. There's not much that Boris Johnson has thrown at Starmer that's really stuck, a kind of Remainer lawyer, maybe. I think the one critique that probably has stuck that Boris Johnson has used on multiple occasions in the chamber is this idea of Captain Hindsight.
Captain Hindsight is rising rapidly up the ranks, has become general indecision, Mr. Speaker.
And that is a bit of a dangerous one to have stuck because, you know, ultimately, and it is something you hear from voters.
He dithers, we get on with the job.
Are they going to give the government the benefit of the doubt of the way they've handled the pandemic? Just, you know, to say, obviously what happened is terrible, but could anyone have done any better under the circumstances? And all this sniping just doesn't help. You know, obviously the answer is, not to get too deep into pandemic analysis, that could anyone have done any better under the circumstances? Undoubtedly, yes, they could have done. And Labour needs to be making those arguments. But, you know, I think even if he's painted that way, all is not necessarily lost because for Labour, because actually I think what will be the most important issue of the next election is the way the economy is performing. And that's the moment that Keir Starmer really needs to seize, and needs to seize now ahead of this, what we think is going to be a very difficult winter.
The Labour Party's annual conference kicks off in Brighton tomorrow. And the moment everyone will be waiting for is Keir Starmer's speech on Wednesday. How important is it in asserting Starmer in the public imagination?
I think it's fair to say this might be the kind of crucial moment of his leadership, the turning point. I've been having a lot of discussions with shadow cabinet ministers, MPs, sort of senior people in the party, and they know that that's how it's being seen. I think, you know, some of them would prefer for it not to be like that, but even the people closest to Starmer know that there's so much riding on this, on one speech. And it's kind of funny to think that, isn't it? Because, you know, how much real cut through does the meat of a speech by the leader of the opposition at his party conference get? I mean, if you're listening to music radio, which is how people in politics actually tend to judge these things, that it will probably cut through to the bulletins on Radio 1. But, you know, there'll be time for a short snippet of what the policy has to say there. And what will more filter out, I think, is the perception of Starmer into the public, how it's analysed afterwards, how it forces the Tories to respond, whether he looks like a kind of strong leader in control of his narrative, in control of the party, ready to present himself to the electorate as an alternative government, or whether he looks like he's someone who's still struggling to define himself and who doesn't quite have the support of his party.
So next week could be really momentous for Starmer. But can one speech really do that much heavy lifting and change what we think of a leader? Can you remember any times it has?
I feel like it was easier to recall the bad ones, isn't it? probably it's fair to say that calamitous ones are remembered. People obviously remember that moment when Theresa May was supposed to be putting her critics to bed and ended up just not being able to speak by the end of it.
And we...
being harassed by a prankster who gave her a P45. And, you know, Jeremy Corbyn's first speech to Labour conference was kind of well received, but he did sort of read things off the teleprompter that he wasn't supposed to read, like strong message here.
We need to be investing in skills, investing in our young people, and strong message here.
I think Ed Miliband did that speech where he forgot to mention the deficit, which was, you know, sort of went down as one of the most disastrous speeches in Labour history.
And look, you know, in a way, I could just stand there and read out a speech that's been prepared earlier. I like it as a way of engaging with people. And of course, it's one of the perils of it is that there are bits that get left out.
The most famous speech of Ian Duncan Smith when he was party leader, where he got a rapturous standing ovation, said he was the quiet man turning up the volume.
The quiet man is here to stay, and he's turning up the volume.
And then he was gone by November.
Quiet man silence.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, we talked about Starmer's popularity with the electorate, but for him in particular, this is also about persuading members of his own party, isn't it, at this stage?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the big tasks Keir Starmer has is to present a united front a united party. The complaint that voters often say is that, you know, Labour can't even organise itself. It can't even agree with itself.
That was a critique he was really determined to address when he became leader, when he made a lot of noise promising to unify the party. How is that looking for him now as we head into this conference?
So heading into this conference and, you know, as you say, having spent a lot of time saying he wants the Labour Party to turn outward, spend less time in inward debate, we're going into conference now yet again with a Labour leader to proposing some very controversial rule changes to how the party elects its leader, how it selects or deselects MPs, and how it makes policy. But probably the most controversial one is the way that the party elects its leader, and it's to go back to the electoral college system, which means that MPs have a lot more sway over how they decide the leader than ordinary members and trade union members. So they make up a third of the voting base, so do members, so do trade unionists. But obviously, there are far fewer MPs, meaning, you know, by weight, they have a lot more sway over the decision. And Jeremy Corbyn was elected under a system that was actually introduced by Ed Miliband, which is one member, one vote. So it doesn't really matter if you're a member of the shadow cabinet or if you're an ordinary Labour member or if you're just an affiliate member in a trade union, your vote counts for the same. Starmer says that it's all his idea to do these changes. It's all about, you know, having a system in place. And this is the case for the changes to selections of MPs as well, where the party spends a lot less time talking about these issues, a lot less time having these kind of internal rows, and that something is fixed and certain and settled. You can see behind that, he's also trying to send a signal of this party will never elect a leader like Jeremy Corbyn ever again, which is what he thinks will be a good signal to send to parts of the electorate who really dislike Jeremy Corbyn. But as you can see, it's such a red rag to a bull to sections of the party's left and to trade unions. Particularly Unite felt very blindsided by these reforms and are quite angry that there's been no pitch rolling with them. But Sharon Graham, the General Secretary of Unite, who's replaced Len McCluskey, her entire platform for which she stood on as Unite General Secretary was that she was not going to get involved in Labour politics. She said that her focus will be entirely on industrial disputes and workers and workers' rights. And she saw Starmer on Monday. I understand that's when she told him she wasn't going to be at conference, and she said it was because she wanted to be on picket lines with workers. And he said that that was absolutely fine. What they're angry about is he actually didn't take the opportunity in that meeting to say, we're about to do these major party reforms, and they actually leaked out that evening. So there's definitely some anger and bitterness there, and Unite have been the ones trying to rally all the other unions round to say, let's delay these reforms, let's not have this confrontation at conference.
So this unity promise, is it fair to say that it's not going very well?
So I think that are things more united in the parliamentary party than they were in the Corbyn era? Yes, but that's not that difficult because they were, you know, incredibly divided in the Corbyn era, in that the majority of Labour MPs at that point did not want Jeremy Corbyn to be the leader. I think that's not true currently. I think the majority of Labour MPs still think Keir Starmer should be the leader of the party. But ultimately, there is more party unity now because Starmer has very successfully managed to consolidate his wing of the party's hold over all the levers of power within the party. He's got a majority on the ruling National Executive Committee. He's got his own choice in as General Secretary. Anyone basically who was left over from the Corbyn era has either kind of sworn loyalty or has departed. And so he does have, you know, significant power to do what he wants with the party, to take it in the direction that he wants to take it, in a way that Jeremy Corbyn really struggled with for the first couple of years, maybe even 3 or 4 years of his leadership.
Even if Starmer is more in control of the party and its direction, Labour itself still isn't in very good financial shape, is it?
So Labour, you know, inherited quite a difficult financial situation, especially post an election. They're losing party members. Trade union funding, in the way that, you know, Unite funding to Jeremy Corbyn could almost be seen as a certainty under Len McCluskey. That certainty certainly doesn't exist for Starmer under Sharon Graham, although, you know, I'm sure there will be some funding, but perhaps not to that that great extent. And they're also facing a series of costly legal battles and having fought three general elections in 6 years. The party's finances are really in a dire strait. In July, David Evans, who's the party's general secretary, said that they were seeking to make at least 90 redundancies. And the two unions represent Labour staff, GMB Unite, have balloted for strike action. I mean, that again, you know, it's terrible that the party's finances are in such a terrible state, but it's also, it is not a good look for a Labour leader to be potentially facing strike action from its own staff.
And that's not the only challenge Starmer has at the moment. I mean, what are the other issues that the party is struggling with?
One of the issues that Starmer wanted to deal with comprehensively in his first year was anti-Semitism, and you know, the recommendations of what was quite a damning report by the EHRC into the way that anti-Semitism was handled under Jeremy Corbyn. And that has involved a pretty painful overhaul of the complaints process, but also has involved the suspension of Jeremy Corbyn as a Labour MP, although his party membership has been restored. And that is something that is still in a kind of state of paralysis, which, you know, will continue, I think, to be a real thorn in Starmer's side if it can't be resolved to the satisfaction of all the parties involved. One of the more live issues at the moment that I expect to be an issue at party conference is the discussion of trans rights. People from the women's PLP, most notably Rosie Duffield, who have taken on this kind of gender critical stance, which a lot of particularly Labour's younger supporters feel is transphobic. Again, there doesn't seem to be a huge willingness from the leadership to kind of engage, to stand up for trans rights, to kind of make the clear statements that sort of many of its supporters generally would like to see him make. And I suspect we're going to see those arguments played out over the conference season. And also, you know, there's likely to be still sort of further rows, you know, about how the party tackles its approach to lots of things that were pledges in Starmer's initial leadership run, you know, whether that be pledges on climate change, whether that be pledges on nationalisation, on tuition fees. Big calls that he's going to have to make pretty soon if he wants to start talking about them and wants them to cut through.
It does sound like there's a number of key conversations that Starmer has ducked and he hasn't really made his position clear on. Going back to this big conference speech, this is his chance to really lay out his vision. Do you know what he might talk about? I mean, have there been any clues?
So the focus, I think, for Starmer, which his team really believes should be the kind of driving force of the Labour Party, is on jobs, on job security, on dignity at work, and making Labour the party of the worker, of working people, in a way that the Tories are more and more, you know, becoming the party of the landlord and the party of the pensioner. And, you know, that's, I think, the theme that he will want to run through everything. I think you'll see Starmer build on this personal narrative he has. There was a hint of it in his TUC conference speech where he talks about how his father used to work from 8 till 5 in a factory and come home for dinner and then go back to work again just to provide enough for his family. And how even after all of that, he felt like people looked down on him for being a factory worker, that they didn't respect him. And, you know, that's something Starmer will say he feels kind of passionately about changing.
So Starmer has now published a rather grand 12,500-word essay titled The Road Ahead. But if the medium is the message, it's not exactly the zingiest way of communicating who he is. But what did it reveal?
So it's definitely not the zingiest way of communicating who he is. And, you know, one could argue he could do with an editor. But it certainly has got people talking about it because of how lengthy it is. And I think the intention behind it is to kind of show those critics who say they don't know what Starmer stands for, they don't know what his personal philosophy is, they don't understand what his values are or what he wants to achieve as prime minister. I mean, this kind of answers it. If you've written 12,500 words on those issues, then you can't say that you've never spelt them out. As someone who has read the full thing, what it strikes me and what we wrote in the paper is that it sets Labour really on a very decisive course towards the centre ground. The emphasis is strongly all the way through of hard work will get you places. You must contribute to society, and society should reward you for your contributions, and that government should be in a good partnership with the private sector. It essentially sweeps away lots of those kind of promises of large-scale nationalisation. It doesn't explicitly say that. There's not actually very much explicit policy in it at all. But it's a statement of intent that he wants to look forward at issues that he feels are really critical to British people, like healthcare, failing to see their doctors, childcare, they have to pay for pencils at their children's school. He feels like large-scale renationalisations of water companies or Royal Mail, broadband providers are just not the top of people's priorities. And it also, you know, there are things in there that are going to alarm, you know, some of the left, because it feels like some of it apes the language of the right. So he pledges fiscal responsibility and repairing the public finances. That's going to disappoint some people who thought that Starmer should be making a kind of big Joe Biden-esque offer on spending on the economy, stimulating jobs, growth, by taking a more statist approach.
Coming up, can Keir Starmer turn Labour's fortune around? Or is time running out?
So how long do you think Starmer has really to make his mark? I mean, there's sort of rumblings, I think, Jess, that the Tories are now looking ahead at the next election.
Yeah, yes. And I think that the possibility of a election in 2022, you know, is moderate, and the potential for an election in 2023 is very high. I think that's the footing that Boris Johnson's put his new reshuffled cabinet on, and particularly Michael Gove's promotion shows that, you know, he's Secretary of State for levelling up. So he's essentially Secretary of State for a Tory election slogan. It sounds to me like he's preparing for one fairly imminently. I think Labour will be in severe practical difficulties for the financial reasons, as we've just discussed, and also because, you know, in activist terms, if there's an election next year. But, you know, I think that it makes it all the more necessary that he has a lot to say, whether that's concrete policies or not. You know, I spoke to a shadow cabinet minister a couple of days ago who said, you know, even in the Labour 97 manifesto, lots of the concrete policies often were quite small fry. It was about the vision, the purpose that Blair and that Labour team created around themselves, that sense of momentum. And that's all as important as, you know, the policy offer.
So when you speak to Labour MPs, what do they think of the party's chances in the next election?
I think most of them are pretty pessimistic. And I think, you know, some of them think that even in some Red Wall seats where Labour is still kind of clinging on by a thread, that there are more seats that Labour could lose. There are obviously some signs that there are other seats where demographics are moving in Labour's favour, particularly as younger voters, people in more insecure work, are priced out of big cities or decide to leave big cities. And those cities could include Bristol or Brighton, as well as London and Manchester. So there are places that Labour needs to exploit that demographic move. It also would need to win significant portions of the Red Wall back. Again, the majorities are small in a lot of those places, so that's not beyond the realms of possibility. But it also probably needs to start winning back some sizable chunks of Scotland as well. It will be a combination of the three, of those new seats, of those old seats in the Red Wall, and some of the old seats in Scotland as well that Labour win back. It will be some, but not all of them. That's a huge task. That means that Labour has to basically present a vision that appeals to the whole country.
So with the stakes that high, if next week goes wrong, how dangerous a moment is this for Starmer? Are there other candidates waiting in the wings?
I think it's fair to say that there are other candidates waiting in the wings, and it is a moment of peril for him. But I think one of the things that's saving Starmer is the two main candidates who might challenge him. The path for both of them looks very difficult. The first one is Andy Burnham, the mayor of Greater Manchester, who's made it pretty explicit in a lot of interviews that he's given that he fancies the Labour leadership and that he intends to run for the Labour leadership at some point. He is very popular in Greater Manchester. He's got his own power base. He's not dependent on Starmer because he's got his own electoral mandate. He's got lots of MPs who really like him, who are loyal to him. But at the moment, he can't run for the leadership because he isn't an MP. He's the mayor of Greater Manchester. So there's no prospect of him challenging, although if Starmer's unlucky enough to see a by-election in Greater Manchester, then Andy Burnham may well go for it and we may well see that happen. But, you know, at the moment, that doesn't seem that likely. Mm. The other person who has always mentioned as a potential challenger to Starmer is Angela Rayner, his deputy. Those two had a big falling out after the Hartlepool by-election, where there was attempts to demote Rayner from the shadow cabinet, and she emerged with this huge clutch of new titles, more powerful than ever. Although she served in Jeremy Corbyn's shadow cabinet, she's not really seen as one of them by the left wing of the party. She's not really trusted by them. And similarly, because she served in Jeremy Corbyn's shadow cabinet, she's not really trusted by the right of the party. So she wouldn't have an easy time of it if that's what she decided to do. But I think a lot of people do feel that Rayner has some strengths that Starmer doesn't, the way that she communicates with the electorate. She's a former care worker. She's very quick to attack the Tories. She doesn't mind using the kind of language that Starmer's been seen to shy away from. And a lot of people see that as an asset.
So what will a successful conference week look like for Starmer? How should we judge it?
I think a successful conference week would look like two or three pretty eye-catching policies that are memorable, that party members can get excited about, they're excited about talking about on the doorstep, whether that be a big pledge on green jobs, on climate, or on workers' rights, on rebuilding after the pandemic. I think for a lot of them, that will look like recommitting to some of the popular policies on renationalisation that were had before. Whether that'll happen, I don't know. And more broadly, you know, in the media, whether Keir Starmer gets a big reception for his speech, whether he's able to show much more of who he is. He got quite close to that in the interview he gave to Piers Morgan, Life Stories, whether he's able to bring out that character, but also show to present himself as an alternative future prime minister with a shadow cabinet, with a serious policy agenda that looks like a government in waiting. It's a pretty tall order. And I think, you know, if they can't achieve that, then I think they would settle for a generous reception from Labour MPs, a re-infused activist base, and some good headlines that play on the evening news that gives him something to build on for next year if he's given that time by Boris Johnson, which, you know, is 50-50, I would say.
Let's see. Jessica Elgott, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's it for today. My thanks to Jessica Elgott. You can read all the politics team's analysis from the Labour conference at theguardian.com. I'd really recommend Jessica's piece out today on the challenges facing Keir Starmer. This episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Archie Bland. We'll be back on Monday.
This is The Guardian.